Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the August 23rd, 2019 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows the Republican elephant. He's in one of those old wooden structures. I think they call it a pillory, or the stocks where the head is sticking through and the arms. They had put the prisoners in them for humiliating them. And the elephant's got on the Make America Great Again hat, and he's being pummeled with eggs and tomatoes. And the title this week is Shaming the GOP. Is it wrong for the left to out Trump donors? And I think we get that story on the controversy of the week, but we'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. Epstein's final escape from justice, what happened? Attorney General William Barr vowed this week to get to the bottom of serial sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's apparent suicide inside a federal jail cell, as members of Congress demanded answers as to how the wealthy financier was left alone after a previous attempt to kill himself. The FBI opened an investigation into what Barr called serious irregularities at the Bureau of Prisons-run Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan. Early reports suggest the two guards overseeing Epstein slept on their shifts, then falsified logs. Epstein had been placed on suicide watch July 23rd, when abrasions were found on his neck, then was taken off 6 days later at the request of his lawyers. Guards were still supposed to check on him every 30 minutes and house him with a roommate. But his roommate was transferred Friday night and not replaced. Hours later, Epstein was found dead after apparently using a bedsheet to tie a top bunk and to hang himself. Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska, said Epstein's dark secrets were allowed to die with him, and that heads must roll. In the wake of Epstein's death, President Trump provoked outrage when he retweeted a conservative comedian's allegation that former President Bill Clinton somehow engineered the hanging because Epstein had information on him. A Clinton spokesperson said the former president knows nothing about Epstein's crimes and had not spoken to him in well over a decade. Meanwhile, there were news reports that Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, a British socialite described as his procurer, had boasted of possessing dirt on an astonishing number of rich and famous people, and even videotaped visitors to his infamous Caribbean island near St. Thomas. The FBI raided that island this week in search of evidence. About 80 women and girls, some as young as 14, have accused Epstein of raping or sexually abusing them. What the editorial said. While Epstein cheated justice with his death, the investigations into his crimes and those of others connected to him must continue, said the New York Times. Nothing short of a full accounting is required to restore faith in a system that too often tilts toward the powerful at the expense of the vulnerable. The public officials who have repeatedly failed Epstein's victims are long overdue for a reckoning. Trump is playing a dangerous game by peddling conspiracy theories, said the Miami Herald. Not only is the president, who socialized with Epstein in the 1990s and early 2000s and publicly called him a terrific guy, undercutting his own Justice Department's investigation in Epstein's death, he's also exploiting the unending pain of Epstein's victims to deliver another nonsensical partisan rant to his base. What the columnist said. Epstein's death leaves prosecutors with one prime target, said Mark Fisher in the Washington Post. The Paris-born, Oxford-educated Ghislaine Maxwell, 57, met Epstein less than a year after her father, a British publishing tycoon and member of parliament, died $4 billion in debt. His victims say she became the prime organizer of his thrice-daily massages from underage girls recruited on the pretext they were auditioning for modeling jobs. In court documents released just before Epstein's death, one of Epstein's victims, Virginia Roberts Guffrey, said Maxwell had recruited her and ordered her to have sex with Epstein and numerous famous friends, including Britain's Prince Andrew. It shouldn't be possible for a hideous monster like Epstein to game the American system of justice, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. But that's exactly what he did. Again and again, the wealthy predator enjoyed advantages and breaks unimaginable to anyone who didn't jet around with influential friends. His high-priced legal team got him a slap on the wrist for a 2002 guilty plea and even just got him removed from suicide watch. What a rare opportunity missed, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. Since the 2008 financial crisis, Americans have been left feeling there are two sets of rules, one for ordinary Americans and another for the rich and well-connected. Epstein's recent arrest looked like a chance to finally hold rotten elites to account, with this pampered child rapist likely to spend the rest of his life in a jail cell. Instead, his death represents one final escape from accountability. And our controversy, as we referred to in the description of the cover drawing, shaming Trump donors, fair game or out of bounds? Since when did it become acceptable to target private citizens for their political opinions, said Carol Markowitz in the New York Post. Liberals have worked themselves into such moral outrage over President Trump, they think anyone who donates money to his 2020 campaign is complicit in this great evil and therefore fair game. Last week, droves of outraged blue staters canceled or claimed they canceled their memberships to Equinox and SoulCycle, the high-priced New Agey fitness centers, because Stephen Ross, billionaire owner of both gyms' parent company, hosted a fundraiser for President Trump in the Hamptons. Just days earlier, Democratic Representative Joaquin Castro, presidential candidate Julian Castro's twin brother and campaign manager, tweeted out the names of 44 San Antonio residents who had donated the maximum $2,800 to Trump's reelection campaign and accused them of fueling a campaign of hate that labels Hispanic immigrants as invaders. In the current polarized atmosphere, this retaliatory intimidation is dangerous, said Guy Benson in townhall.com. Castro's clear goal was for anti-Trump partisans to find and punish these people for their political beliefs. The same hypocritical liberals who blamed the El Paso massacre on Trump's incitement are now circulating hit lists of Republican donors, including the home addresses of retired people. What Castro did was not doxing, said Suzanne Nossel in the New York Times. That Twitter-era term means the unauthorized sharing of your political opponent's private information, unlisted phone numbers, home addresses, names of children's schools, etc. A person's history of political contributions, by contrast, is publicly available information in our democracy, and rightly so. As long as it never crosses the line into harassment or menace, calling out people for their donations is absolutely fair game. Trump's donors deserve to be named and shamed, said Zach Cheney Rice in nymag.com. They're giving their money to ensure a two-term presidency for a virulent bigot. The left's shaming of Trump supporters won't work, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. Trump's fans don't think he's a racist and don't think they are either. But they do believe that liberals are out to get them, using charges of racism and white supremacy to drive them out of polite society. These shaming campaigns will only rally Trump supporters to his side. The true believers may feel that way, said Michael McGuff in the Los Angeles Times. But those who supported Trump for cynical reasons, such as their gratitude for his tax cut for corporations, may find the charge that they are actively funding Trump's xenophobia, hatred, and racism a hard argument to refute. These two cases aren't the same, said New York Daily News in an editorial. It makes perfect strategic sense for socially conscious gym-goers to let Stephen Ross know that lending big-dollar support to an unstable, dangerous, and divisive president may have consequences for the bottom line. But the public shaming of individuals who gave Trump less than $3,000, that's a path toward endless civic warfare. With his constant Twitter trolling of his opponents, Trump bears some responsibility for this, said Jonathan Tobin in NationalReview.com. But in insisting that anyone who supports him is unworthy of even minimal respect, liberals are turning their backs on the basic rules of American democracy. As both sides gear up for 2020, the nastiness to come will likely make Castro's tweet seem like a church picnic. And we'll move into our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems that it was a good week for Modern Families after two gay male penguins at the Berlin Zoo adopted an abandoned egg and will hatch a chick in early September. Skipper and Ping, who are inseparable, are taking turns to keep the egg warm, said a zoo spokesman. It's also a good week for cat people. After scientists announced the development of a vaccine for the cat allergies that afflict up to 10% of the U.S. population. The vaccines eliminate a protein that triggers allergic reactions and is delivered by injection to the cat, not its owner. And it was a good week for eco-constipation. After Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro defended Amazon deforestation by saying that if people want to help the environment, they should poop every other day instead of daily. That would be better for the whole world, he added. But it was a bad week for range. After a 65-year-old Chinese man was hospitalized with a collapsed lung following a marathon karaoke session in which he hit some very high notes. I was very excited in the heat of the moment, said the man, identified in the news reports only as Wang. It was a bad week for screen time, with a new study showing that the percentage of British teenagers needing glasses soared from 20% to 35% between 2012 and 2018. The teens spend an average of 26 hours a week staring at a smartphone or other screen. And finally, it was a bad week for Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York and Democratic presidential candidate, who received a mere 23 corn kernels out of 20,000 cast in the Iowa State Fair's quirky poll of its attendees. The goal is to keep building, the unfazed candidate told the New York Post. Our briefing page article this week is titled, The Graying of America. The number of Americans 65 and older is projected to nearly double by 2060. Why does this matter? America is in the midst of a profound demographic transformation that will render its population significantly older in the years to come. In 2014, the percentage of Americans age 65 and older was 15%, already an all-time high. By 2030, that will rise to 21%, and by 2060, a remarkable 24% of Americans will be in their golden years. By 2035, the number of those 65 and older will surpass Americans under age 18 for the first time in the country's history. This graying is already well underway. In 1970, the median American age was 28.1 years. 46 years later, in 2016, the median age was 37.9. As the median age continues to advance, it could have transformational consequences for large swaths of American life, including the workforce, the economy, the solvency of the social safety net, even the way sidewalks are engineered. What's driving this transformation? A confluence of factors. Americans are not only living longer. One born in 1900 could expect only 47.3 years, but fewer of them are being born. In 2018, the crop of newborns was the lowest since 1986, about 3.78 million, continuing a downward trend that some are now labeling the baby bust. The dramatic birth rate decline is occurring at the same time that America's second largest generation, the 77 million strong baby boomers, born between 1946 and 64, are moving into old age. Boomers are now turning 65 at a rate of between 8,000 to 10,000 a day. By 2030, all of them will be older than 65. In the face of these statistics, the U.S. Census Bureau has sounded the alarm, calling 2030 a demographic turning point for the country. Why else is 2030 significant? It's the year when America's so-called dependency ratio, or the percentage of non-working citizens who rely on those who are employed, will exceed 70%. This will have profound consequences for Social Security and Medicare, the former of which is now projected to exhaust its $2.9 trillion reserve by 2035. At that point, unless Congress increases taxes or cuts benefits, only payroll taxes from a shrinking workforce would finance the program, and benefits would likely be reduced by 20%. Employers have mostly eliminated pensions, and boomers have an average of only $152,000 in retirement savings, far too little for a 20-year retirement. 45% of boomers currently have no retirement savings. A Gallup poll found that 74% of Americans plan to work past 65, with some boomers becoming workampers who combine work and retirement by buying an RV and touring a seasonal rotation of places to work. You might see them logging hours as a NASCAR usher in Florida, a security guard at a Texas oil field, or taking tickets for whale watching tours in Maine. Will this affect the economy? As the percentage of Americans with full-time jobs drops, so too will the GDP. Researchers from Harvard's Medical School and the RAND Corporation recently compared the growth rates of states that are aging at different paces. Their findings were startling. For every 10% jump in the portion of a population over 60, economic growth fell 5.5%. Nationally, the group estimated the aging of America's workforce has already lopped 1.2% off GDP this decade. This may explain why the average rate of growth has been a meager 2.3% since 2009. Another vexing question is how well America's consumer-driven economy will hold up when so many of us are living frugally on fixed incomes. How about health care? American spending on health care is expected to rise from about $4 trillion a year to $6 trillion, or 19.4% of GDP, by 2027. By 2025, U.S. healthcare providers believe they will face a collective shortage of about 500,000 home health aides, 100,000 nursing assistants, and 29,000 nurse practitioners. Some are also bracing for a shortage of up to 122,000 doctors by 2032. This problem was complicated by Congress capping Medicare reimbursement to teaching hospitals for each resident in 1997, when there was talk of a doctor glut. What other problems are ahead? Cities will need to adjust their infrastructure for older people. Crosswalk timers will have to be reset to give them more time to get across the street, and far more curb cutouts for walkers and wheelchairs will need to be installed. The number of homebound, isolated seniors will dramatically rise, contributing to an existing loneliness epidemic. The isolation, ironically, will be worse in the sidewalkless, car-oriented suburbs America created to make baby boomers' childhood so utopian. What happens to tens of millions of suburban residents when they're 85 and unable to drive or walk to stores, community centers, or doctors? In the 60s, the majority of people weren't living past 70 or 75, said Hilda Werstadt, a research associate with the MIT Age Lab. We're entering into this new era that we just have not seen before. Not just an American problem. The U.S. is not the only country with a rapidly aging population. Between 2015 and 2030, the number of people 60 years or older worldwide is expected to grow by 56%, from around 900 million to nearly 1.5 billion. In China alone, those over 65 are projected to spike from 8% of the population to 24% in just 30 years. Other countries have already begun adjusting in ways that the U.S. can copy or learn from. In France, people can now pay to have postal workers check in on elderly kin in rural areas. In Yokohama, Japan, officials incentivize citizens to stay fit by donating about $1,900 to the United Nations World Food Program whenever participating pedestrians average more than 100,000 steps a month. Japanese companies such as Sony and SoftBank are marketing a line of robot puppies and baby seals as a balm for elderly loneliness. Just looking at it makes people smile, said one Japanese nursing home manager of a robot seal. At the Shintomi Nursing Home in Tokyo, sing-alongs are now led by a four-foot-tall android named Pepper. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. This one's titled, Is Biden Really the Most Electable? Coverage of political gaffes is often overwrought, said Aaron Blake. Any politician is bound to say dumb things now and then, given how often they speak publicly. But Democrats who view former Vice President Joe Biden as their strongest challenger to President Trump have to be concerned after Biden's cringeworthy performance while campaigning in Iowa last week. In one speech, the 76-year-old Biden raised eyebrows when he said that, quote, poor kids are just as bright and just as talented as white kids, end quote. For the second time in recent weeks, he referred to former British Prime Minister Theresa May as Margaret Thatcher, and at one point urged Democrats to choose truth over facts. Perhaps the most worrisome was his claim that survivors of the 2018 Parkland school shooting came up to see me when I was vice president. Biden was not vice president in 2018. Now Biden has shown an unmatched ability to connect with audience, but his spate of stumbles is a bad sign. In the pressure of general election campaign against Trump, could the undisciplined Biden say something so damaging it could torpedo his chances? If the gaffes continue, Democrats may have to question their assumption about Biden's superior electability. Making sure victims don't survive. Former Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan once proposed a huge tax on the most damaging kinds of ammunition, explaining, "Guns don't kill people, bullets do." Recent mass shootings have proved that the late senator was onto something, said Francis Wilkinson. In his sick manifesto, the El Paso shooter lovingly explains his choices of an AK-47-style semi-automatic weapon and the AM-3 bullet, which has a cult following because it expands and fragments when it hits human flesh, causing catastrophic wounds. In publications such as the NRA's official journal, Shooting Illustrated, bullet talk is as revealing a window on American gun culture as gun talk. In one ammo review, the writer gives his thumbs up to Hornady brand bullets' ability to penetrate thick clothing and expand inside the body, causing deep wound cavities. When this kind of ammo is paired with semi-automatic rifles, which fire bullets at triple the velocity of most handguns, the effects are especially gruesome and lethal. Surgeons who've treated victims of assault rifle mass shootings say organs are so badly shredded that there is nothing left to repair. Why are we selling hyper-lethal guns and bullets designed and marketed to make sure shooting victims can't possibly survive? This is a from Europe, a How They See Us column, a threat to pull troops from Germany. Germany is risking its most important alliance, said Philipp Volkmann-Schulk in Bild from Germany. That was the message the U.S. ambassador in Berlin, Richard Grenell, delivered last week, warning that America will remove its troops from the country and relocate them to Poland unless Germany honors its NATO defense spending obligations. Alliance members are supposed to spend at least 2% of their gross domestic product on defense, but we spend less than 1.4% on the military. The German government is even planning to lower the rate after 2021. Grenell fumed at how offensive it is to assume that the U.S. taxpayer must continue to pay to have 50,000-plus Americans in Germany, but the Germans get to spend their surplus on domestic programs. The ambassador was echoing what U.S. President Donald Trump has long insisted. Germans aren't paying their fair share. To hear the Trump administration tell it, the U.S. troops here are an undeserved gift to the Germans, said Stefan Braun in Süddeutsche Zeitung. Nothing could be further from the truth. During the Cold War, America's bases in Germany served as a bulwark against the Soviets, defending Europe and the U.S. And Germany is now the linchpin of global U.S. operations, said Christoph von Marschall. The U.S. base at Ramstein serves warplanes and drones that fly missions in the Middle East and Africa, while the Landstuhl Military Hospital has treated thousands of American troops wounded in Afghanistan and Iraq. Stuttgart hosts the U.S. Command Center for the European and African theaters, and Grafenwöhr boasts a vast training ground. All these facilities are worth billions of dollars and could not easily be replicated in Poland. Nor would it be legal under a NATO-Russian agreement to station so many U.S. troops in a former Warsaw Pact nation. The U.S. president doesn't care about upholding treaties, said Konrad Schuller, but that doesn't mean he'll follow through with his threat. He's a professional bluffer. Remember 2 years ago when he threatened North Korea with fire and fury if it didn't dismantle its nuclear program? Pyongyang keeps testing missiles, but Trump makes excuses for this behavior and praises dictator Kim Jong-un. Same with Iran. Trump sent aircraft carriers to the Persian Gulf to protect ships, yet when Iran sabotaged and confiscated tankers, he did nothing. Trump will not do what he threatens. Trump and Grinnell's style may be harsh, said Marc-Felix Serrao in Neue Zürcher Zeitung from Switzerland, but they're telling the truth. Europe's largest economy really isn't doing its bit to help defend Europe. Underspending has crippled the German military. Warplanes have been grounded for lack of spare parts. Troops are going without bulletproof vests and winter clothes. And fewer than 50% of tanks are battle-ready. Berlin should step up defense spending, not because of Trump's threats, but because it's in Germany's national interest. And we're on to the last word, our in-depth article. This week it's titled, The Amazon Nomads. Roving merchants scour the country searching for odd and quirky items they can sell through Amazon, said journalist Josh Ziza in TheVerge.com. It's a life of constant searching, open sky, and nothing left to lose. Chris Anderson moves through the Target clearance racks with a cool efficiency, surveying the towers of Star Wars Lego sets and Incredibles action figures, sensing, as if by tuition, what would be profitable to sell on Amazon. Discontinued nail polish can be astonishingly lucrative, but not these colors. A dinosaur riding some sort of motorcycle? No way. But these Jurassic Park Jeeps look promising, and an Amazon app on his phone confirms that each could net a $6 profit after fees and shipping. He piles all 20 into his cart. It's not a bad haul for a half hour's work, but it's not great either. He consoles himself that he hit upon a trove of deeply discounted Kohl's bras the day before as he left East Brunswick, New Jersey, on his way here to Edison. Home is still 300 miles away in Tyrone, Pennsylvania, and there are plenty of stores between here and there. Anderson is an Amazon nomad, part of a small group of merchants who travel the back roads of America searching clearance aisles and dying chains for goods to sell on Amazon. Some live out of RVs and vans moving from town to town, only stopping long enough to pick the stores clean and ship their wares to Amazon's fulfillment centers. The majority of goods sold on Amazon are not sold by Amazon itself, but by more than 2 million merchants who use the company's platform as their storefront and infrastructure. Some of these sellers make their own products, while others practice arbitrage, buying and reselling wares from other retailers. Amazon has made this easy to do, first by launching Fulfillment by Amazon, which allows sellers to send their goods to company warehouses and have Amazon handle storage and delivery, and then with an app that lets sellers scan goods to instantly check whether they'd be profitable to sell on the site. A few sellers, like Anderson, have figured out that the best way to find lucrative products is to be mobile, scouring remote stores and chasing hot-selling items from coast to coast. It's almost like I'm the front end of the business and Amazon is just an extension of my arm, said Sean Patrick Isles, a nomad who spent weeks driving cross-country during the Toys R Us final days. It was a feeding frenzy Anderson and others also hit the road for. I find the products, and then they mail them to the people. Though nomadism offers competitive advantages, most of the merchants I spoke with cited more personal reasons for their profession. Freedom, Jason Wyatt quickly answers when I asked him why he decided to quit his job as an aviation electronics technician, sell his house in Georgia, and buy an RV. Janis Joplin once said, though I believe it was actually Kris Kristofferson's song, "Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose." And I found that that's actually the truth. Your possessions, you don't really own them. They own you. The more you get rid of, the freer you are. This is not an uncommon refrain from the nomads, who often have a complicated relationship with consumerism. Too much stuff can be a burden on the road, so they can find themselves living like ascetics amid the clearance aisles, servicing, in Anderson's word, literally the best product distribution system ever devised by the human race. At 32, Anderson is burly with a youthful face and shoulder-length dark hair tucked behind his ears. His black shorts and t-shirt reveal tattoos of aliens, cats, skulls, and iconography from Radiohead and Misfits. Coupled with the white, windowless cargo van he drives, the whole ensemble gives him the appearance of a cheerful roadie, one of the many jobs he's briefly held. Anderson adopted the nomadic life partly out of necessity. A restless person, by his own admission, he dropped out of college 3 years in, getting all the debt without the degree. He started making jewelry, wedding bands and titanium plugs like the Space Invaders ones he's now wearing, but it wasn't enough to live on. He worked retail, he worked in a call center, then looking for ways to sell his jewelry, he came across Amazon. It was a terrible platform for selling crafts. He couldn't make things fast enough to meet Amazon's requirements. But retail arbitrage looked interesting. He moved to Tyrone, and the nearest Walmart was 20 miles away. So any shopping trips would have to be road trips anyway. He figured he might as well keep driving to Wisconsin, to Florida, to Nevada. Today he runs a warehouse, packing products for other Amazon sellers, and spends half his time on the road chasing product. When you spend weeks on end traveling the strip malls and big box stores of America, you start to appreciate small differences in what can seem like archipelagos of sameness. The way the Targets get cleaner as you approach the corporate headquarters in Minneapolis. The novelty of an unusually small Walmart in Indiana. The McDonald's in Pomeroy, Ohio, that served pizza, the reminder of an abandoned experiment in the 80s. How was the McPizza? Bad, Anderson says exuberantly, but that's not the point. Finished with Target, Anderson stacks the Jeeps in the back of his van and gives the cart a shove, sending it rattling into its corral. Sometimes he confides when he finishes shopping late at night, he'll bump his cart with his van to knock it into its pen as he leaves, a parting flourish in the empty lot. Often, sellers will invent destinations to give their travels a direction. Anderson likes to follow bands. He recently followed the Mountain Goats across four states and is planning to do the same this summer when Tool goes on the tour. National parks are a popular destination, which can create a distinctly American-feeling juxtaposition of natural splendor and commerce, big stores and open sky. Isles reminisces about waking up in his van to see the sun rising over the Grand Canyon after a weeks-long tour of closing Toys R Us stores. Anderson takes detours for roadside attractions like the largest basket in Ohio, and he always stops for caves. But sometimes the Amazon app, acting as a Geiger counter of consumer demand, will light up on something strange, and it's time to chase a product. Anderson recently hit half a dozen Walmarts buying Game of Thrones Oreos. You learn to develop an eye for things that could set off the scanner. Oh, weird cleaning products. I love them, Anderson says as he leaves a TJ Maxx aisle full of plastic avocado half containers and Jim Beam-branded steak knives. There are objects that are intentionally scarce and marketed as such, like the Oreos. And then there are everyday things that simply vanish in the churn of seasonal redesigns and obsolescence. The attachments people develop for these unremarkable commodities can be intense, at least as measured by their prices on Amazon. For Anderson, the holy grail is the Bounce dryer bar, a $5 plastic oblong you affix to the dryer rather than adding a dryer sheet to each load. Now discontinued, a two-pack sells on Amazon for $300. Anderson once hunted a particular brand of discounted dental floss for the Big Lots of America, buying six packs for 99 cents and selling them on Amazon for more than $100 apiece. He has no idea why someone would pay so much for such things, but the scanner tells him people do. His best guesses are melancholy ones. Discontinued cat food is a big seller, which he didn't understand until his mom's cat grew old and senile and refused to eat any of the new flavors. He once saw a post from a parent whose son was autistic and drank from the same plastic cup every day for 20 years. The cup eventually disintegrated, and he didn't want to drink from any other vessel. "I've always wondered if it's something like that," Anderson said, "but it can't be that common. Plus, I don't see how you get that attached to it. I could see a cup, but I don't get a dryer bar. In any case, demand exists. Someone bought a $300 dryer bar last month." Life on the road isn't easy. Sellers don't realize how isolating it can be at times, said Isles, who travels between New York and Florida in a Ford conversion van. "It also takes a tremendous amount of work to be financially viable. While there is a robust economy of influencers promising riches through retail arbitrage, the actual margins are unforgiving, and the practice has been declining for years." Isles, who was studying to be a music teacher before he decided it wasn't a viable career, pays himself about $40,000 a year and works long and strange hours, sometimes overturning shopping carts in Walmart parking lots at 3 a.m. to serve as makeshift countertops as he packages goods to send to Amazon. Anderson said he makes about $100,000 a year, of which arbitrage represents roughly half. The nomads must also endure the overwhelming feeling of being confronted with so much stuff. "I started to experience this as the afternoon wore on. By 4 p.m., Anderson and I had been to Target, Ulta, TJ Maxx, Walmart, Kohl's, and had moved on to GameStop. We had seen quivers of yoga mats, pro wrestling action figures, vast Nerf arsenals, and copper-plated pans. There were plush Star Wars droids, plastic dinosaurs, Sour Patch cereal, Churro Cinnamon Toast Crunch cereal. Weird cereal can be lucrative," Anderson says. "Elmos, Teddy Ruxpin's, glittering purple bath bombs, body mist that a rival seller had registered as weighing 500 pounds, so the scanner app registered it as unprofitable. Skull-covered American Sniper-branded car seat covers with gun holsters, plastic succulents, TVs, drones, and a toy that was labeled simply Egg. What kind of weird parent gets their kid an egg?" Anderson asks. "There's nothing quite like a clearance section for feeling the intensity and fleetingness of consumer desire. All these plastic leftovers of huge public appetites, which were shaped for a time by enormous companies and have since moved on to robot monkey finger puppets or whatever. The scale is overwhelming." Anderson recalls an auction for a pallet of robotic hamsters called Zuzu Pets, which were briefly hot in 2009 with a Disney Channel cartoon and video games. The pallet was number 20,000. That means somebody imported 20,000 pallets at least. That is an insane number. Doing the math, he comes up with almost 800 tractor trailers full of robot hamsters. "I was surprised at first by how often the nomads distanced themselves from material culture, speaking of their customers and fellow shoppers from an almost anthropological remove. But it makes sense when you realize that they make most of their money by immersing themselves in the pre-holiday buying frenzy. Anderson has Thanksgiving with his mom a day early so he can venture out to the stores, a tradition that dates back to his time working retail. He always brings a buddy. It's too harrowing to face alone. He's seen hungry-eyed adults fighting over TVs and parents crying out in desperation that, without a particular toy, their kid's Christmas will be ruined. Too many people are unhappy, and I don't think they know why they're unhappy. So they're like, I'm going to buy a new toy, and that'll make me happy. And it does not, he says. So many people are owned by their possessions. Anderson is still eager to travel, he says, as we sit outside a Starbucks along a busy road, cars whooshing home in the evening rush hour. He's had depression for a lot of his life, and when he's traveling is when he's happiest. Yesterday he drove through the Pine Barrens, which was beautiful. Tonight he might drive down to Philadelphia and see his dad, or up through Jersey to get dinner with a fellow nomad. It's kind of nice just to be carefree, you know. I'm going to see. Then it's probably off to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where he recently hit a rich vein of discontinued Pop-Tarts. This story originally appeared in TheVerge.com on July 10th and has been edited by The Week. We have an obituary this week that I'll read for you. It's a longer than usual one, and deservedly so. The Nobel laureate who chronicled the black experience, Toni Morrison, 1931 to 2019. Toni Morrison gave voice to millions of people who had long been relegated to the margins of American literature and life. With poetic and often painful language, the Nobel Prize-winning author placed African Americans, particularly women, at the heart of her 11 novels. Many of Morrison's characters were tortured but proud figures who were, she said, unavailable to pity. They included Seth, the runaway slave and beloved from 1987, who commits infanticide rather than see her daughter raised in bondage. Pecola Breedlove, a black girl who struggles with feelings of racial inferiority and longs for eyes like Shirley Temple in The Bluest Eye, 1970. And Macon, Milkman Dead III, who spends decades searching for his roots and identity in Song of Solomon, 1977. Slavery and its brutal legacy coursed through her work. Anybody white could take your whole self for anything that came to mind, Morrison wrote in Beloved, which was set in the 19th century, but read as a metaphor for the 20th. Not just work, kill, or maim you, but dirty you. Dirty you so bad you couldn't like yourself anymore. What drove Morrison to write about the African-American experience, she said in 2003, was the silence. So many stories untold and unexamined. There was a wide vacuum in the literature. She was born Chloe Ardelia Wofford in Lorain, Ohio, to a shipbuilder father and a homemaker mother, said the New York Times. Young Chloe grew up in a house suffused with narrative and superstition. She listened to ghost stories and folk tales told by her parents, both of whom were descended from slaves, and watched her grandmother ritually consulted a book on dream interpretation. At school, Chloe developed a love of literature, especially the novels of Fyodor Dostoevsky and Jane Austen, and went on to study English and classics at the historically black Howard University in Washington, D.C. Classmates struggled to pronounce Chloe, so she started going by Tony, from the baptismal named Anthony, patron saint of the poor and the lost, she had taken on converting to Catholicism at age 12. Soon after earning a master's degree from Cornell University, she joined the Howard faculty, where her students included the civil rights activist Stokely Carmichael, said the Washington Post. In 1958, she wed Harold Morrison, a Jamaican architect. Their marriage was an unhappy one, with Harold believing a wife should be subservient to her husband. "I was a complete nuisance to mine," she said. Morrison started writing fiction to escape. I wrote like someone with a dirty habit, she explained, secretly, compulsively, slyly. One early short story was inspired by a childhood friend who, Morrison said, confessed to losing faith in God because she had prayed for and not been given blue eyes. After getting divorced in 1964, Morrison moved with her two young sons to New York City, taking a job as a senior editor at Random House. Over the next two decades, Morrison would cultivate what she called a canon of black work, editing books by Angela Davis, Tony Cade Bambara, Gail Jones, and Muhammad Ali, and African authors including Wol Soyinka and Chinua Achebe. In her late 30s, Morrison began working on her own novels, writing whenever she could find the time, said Time magazine. She wrote at daybreak when her boys were still asleep and would scribble out paragraphs on her steering wheel while stuck in traffic. Her debut, The Bluest Eye, was set in 1941 and inspired by the Black is Beautiful movement that took off in the 1960s. There was a time when black wasn't beautiful, she said, and you hurt. Her next novel, Sula, 1973, focused on two childhood best friends whose lives radically diverge. Like many of Morrison's books, Sula captured the importance of black sisterhood. It was so critical among black women because there wasn't anybody else, she explained. We saved one another's lives for generations. Nationwide acclaim came with Song of Solomon. It was picked as a main selection by the Book of the Month Club, the first novel by a black author to receive the honor since Richard Wright's Native Son in 1940. But it was Morrison's fifth novel, Beloved, that proved to be her most celebrated work, said the Hollywood Reporter. In a chilling feat of literary invention, Morrison gives words to the slain infant who lives as a ghost with her mother, a symbol of the bloody history that continues to haunt African Americans. I am not dead, says the child, known as Beloved. I sit in the sun, closes my eyes when I open them. I see the face I lost. Sees is the face that left me. The novel was an instant sensation, spending 25 weeks on the bestseller list. When Beloved failed to win a National Book Award in 1988, 48 black writers, including Maya Angelou, Ernest Gaines, and Alice Walker, wrote an open letter protesting the oversight. Later that year, Beloved won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, the first of many major awards for Morrison. She received the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1993, the first black woman to be so honored, and in 2012 was presented with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian award in the U.S., by President Barack Obama. The accolades didn't cause Morrison to slow down. She won acclaim for the improvisational style of Jazz, 1992, which was set in 1920s Harlem and echoed up the strains of black jazz music, said the Daily Telegraph. More novels followed, as well as three children's books, collections of essays, and the libretto for Margaret Garner, an opera about the real-life slave who had inspired Beloved. Her final novel, God Help the Child, which explores childhood trauma visited upon a dark-skinned woman and how it shapes her adulthood, was published in 2015. Word work is sublime, Morrison said in her Nobel lecture in 1993, because it is generative. It makes meaning that secures our difference, our human difference, the way in which we are like no other life. We die. That may be the meaning of life. But we do language. That may be the measure of our lives. And that just leaves us enough time for a few of our shorter notes. We'll start with, since a white supremacist killed nine people at the African American church in Charleston, South Carolina on June 17, 2015, Mass shootings, when four or more people are killed, have occurred every 47 days on average. Before the 1999 Columbine High School shootings, the pace was roughly once every 6 months. Wayne LaPierre, the chief executive of the National Rifle Association, tried unsuccessfully to get the nonprofit organization to buy him a $6 million lakefront mansion last year. LaPierre and his wife said they needed the 10,000 square foot French-style estate in a gated community near Dallas for security reasons after the backlash over the Parkland, Florida school shootings. Gymnast Simone Biles, 22, became the first woman to successfully complete a triple-twisting double somersault in competition en route to winning her record-tying sixth U.S. championship. Only two men have pulled off the move in competition. The home ownership rate among African Americans was 40.6% in June, which is 33 points lower than the white home ownership rate. Black home ownership is at its lowest rate since 1960, largely because people lost so many homes to the predatory lending policies that led to the 2008 financial collapse. And we'll finish out with two quotes. Gore Vidal says, "A narcissist is someone better looking than you are." And from Toni Morrison, quoted in MotherJones.com, she says, "If you can only be tall because somebody is on their knees, then you have a serious problem." And that is it for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The North Carolina Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of the day's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.